This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith today, our guest is Professor Ed Colajay, who's the director of the Center for Global Studies here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Welcome, Ed.
Pleasure to be here.
We're talking today about the whole issue of restoring global order after the failure of the Bush Doctrine. Now, what is the Bush Doctrine?
Well, it's a complicated set of ideas, but let's see if I can get it sententiously stated, which is the notion that the United States is a superpower. Its practices and moral superiority of its people as a model, if you combine moral superiority with superpower assumptions, now you're positioned as a country for the first time, and you can find it in the statements of the president, for the first time in something like 400 years of nation-state conflict, to establish an entirely new revolutionary world order based on democratic regimes.
So the idea that the Bush administration has had is that the U.S. has it right and everybody else should be like us?
No, it's more than just a right. It has an obligation.
Ah, okay.
Which places it in a far more, let's say, advocacy position. In the absence of achieving it, one essentially is morally defective. I believe you can show that in the statements of the president since going back, of course, even before 9/11, but certainly after 9/11.
Now, your field is political science, and mine is, my academic background is in religion, and I don't mean to force my categories on you at all, but is there a sense that from your perspective, America has this evangelistic motive, or that's what's impelling the U.S. to try to take our notion of democracy and send it around the world?
Certainly, if you look at the sweep of American history, at least from the Pilgrims, not the Virginia colony, that's an entirely different orientation. There has been an evangelistic notion of certainly superiority in terms of what we would, as human, as Americans, would achieve as a morally superior form of political and religious practice. Even though we have a separation between religion and state, nevertheless, the motivating force of somehow creating a new society. Now, that view, up until at least the beginning of the 20th century, was taken as exceptionalism in the form of a unique American people as a model for others, those who are capable of reaching the same levels of moral practice and a model are welcome to, in effect, follow the American example, but not necessarily to have it imposed on them. That change occurs, as many people already understand, with the Wilson administration and its rationale for entry into World War I, and then moving rapidly up to the Bush administration with a lot of intervening, let's say, support forms of claims of exceptionalism, that the United States is now in a unique position, and it's the American people more generally, as not only a model, but as a matter of fact, as a kind of in the forefront of what all humans really aspire to, namely something called freedom, and freedom itself, again, in the American mold.
So there's this one exceptional country in the world, the United States of America. It's a city on the hill, to use that phrase from the Bible.
That's right.
The Christian scriptures. And it's a model not only for religion but politics, and there's an obligation to spread that everywhere.
I believe that that's the underlying assumptions of the Bush Doctrine. It doesn't necessarily mean all supporters of American foreign policy necessarily subscribe to that position. But the doctrine itself poses that as the rationale for the exercise of American power, both soft and hard forms of it. And I believe it still animates the president if it doesn't necessarily inform the views of many of his partisans.
Now, let me explain to our listeners that this program is an unusual one for Keeping the Faith in that we will not be asking people to call in with comments or questions, which is a bit unfortunate because this is such a nicely provocative topic. But I'll try to represent some of the concerns I know our listeners have with my questions. But because of your schedule and mine, we're unable to have this be a live show, and so we're pre-recording this for broadcast on Sunday, the 2nd of September. So we will not be accepting phone calls this week, but we'll be back to our regular pattern next week with our guest on Keeping the Faith on September 9th. But for today, we're talking with Professor Ed Colliger, Director of the Center for Global Studies here at the university. He's an emeritus professor from the Department of Political Science, where he was a research professor there. How long were you at the university?
Too long for most of my colleagues. I came to the university from the University of Virginia in 1973 as head of the Department of Political Science. And so I've been here over 30 years.
And where did you do your own study?
I took my PhD in the University of Chicago.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's a small little college up in Chicago.
And where were you an undergraduate?
At Loyola Chicago. And I was in there matriculated between 1952 and 56 and then went across town.
I don't mean to assume too much, but does that imply a Catholic background?
Yes, very, very Catholic.
Where did you grow up?
I assume I'm going to be wafted into heaven immediately with all with all the indulgences I've heard over time. No, I logged, 16 years in Catholic institutions.
Where was that?
Well, in Chicago.
Parochial schools?
Parochial schools, St. Anne Grammar School, in which the primary language, I might add, was Polish, not English. And then we went on to Weber High School, which no longer exists. It's a parking lot, which was taught by the Resurrection Fathers. And then went to the Jesuits at Loyola University and actually came under their aegis. And the program that I was involved was heavily connected with actually Jesuit education.
Did you ever consider the priesthood?
I did, as a matter of fact, much to the chagrin of my family. But then moved on to other less ennobling, let's say, professions.
And is Colliger a Polish name?
Yeah. It means wheeler, actually. Koi is a wheel, and Colliger would be essentially the person who might make wheels.
For our listeners who may not know you by personally or by reputation, spell Colliger for us.
it's more formidable in appearance than in pronunciation. It's K-O. L-O-D-Z-I-J, but the L is actually anglicized. It's not an L in the Polish language. It's a W sound.
How would it be pronounced in Polish?
Kowa, in contrast to Kolo. I just anglicized it in Kolo, but I've kept the rest of the obvious spelling.
I see.
Again, much to the discomfort of most people who see it.
Now, what brought you to this topic at this time in your life?
Well, it's interesting you should say that because there was a time I can identify, November 9th, 1989, and that's the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I understood when I sat all through the night watching the fall of the wall that much of what we were teaching in political science and international relations, frankly, was at best misguided. In short, there existed somehow forces operative that could not be explained simply by military force. They were somehow within the body of the people who were animating the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I pick up on a note you mentioned earlier. You said, well, you're involved in religion, I'm involved in international relations. Increasingly, quite frankly, there's a distinction without a difference. I'm not suggesting a collapse of all forms of international behavior as forms of religious behavior. But the absence of identifying these forces in which one seeks larger aspirations strikes me as indispensable to understand the world we live in. And I'm not saying that just as a throwaway line for this program. If you look at just simply statistics of people who are believers, not just simply Christians, they're all in the entries. And if you want to look at population statistics, it's certainly in favor of those who are being socialized into religious forms of commitment. So if you want to talk about international relations and you excise their religious aspirations as an explanation for behavior, it seems to me that you've essentially emptied out an enormously important cell of explanation.
But that's as you point out, 89 is not that long ago. And I know when I took political science in college, there wasn't much concern for religion. It was as if it was a category that didn't matter.
Well, quite frankly, if you look at most of the curriculum in political science, and I'm sure my colleagues are not going to be cheered by this, you won't find long descriptions except in some marginal discussions dealing with philosophy, and which has been accepted but not integrated in any form. When I studied at the University of Chicago, Leo Strauss was the dominant force. I've never been a Straussian, and we can go into why that occurred. We're not too much a Democrat, quite frankly, small d. But everyone had to take political philosophy, and that implied some notion of moral values in their creation. Which, of course, religion falls in that set of considerations. So it seems to me that increasingly one has to recognize this force, which is intangible, that is the commitment of people to values outside themselves and for which they want to inform and create a new world, right? And the Bush Doctrine, for good or ill, and the president specifically, I think is really motivated seriously by religious concerns. And any effort to understand, seems to me, this president and the doctrine to which he is pursuing with such a relentless focus has to take into account his religious beliefs. I do not purport to be able to explain all of those. That would require biographical discussions for which I'm not capable. But certainly on the surface, namely what I deal with, the doctrine as it crystallizes in the form of projection of American power, the religious motivation below it for this president became a kind of canopy under which all sorts of other people within the administration could march in the support of projection of American power, specifically in Iraq.
Now, motivated by this sense of moral superiority, of religious, having a handle on religious truth that needed to be spread around, and having the political power and the military power to do that.
That's right.
Does that put the Bush Doctrine and its working out in a particularly, I guess, dangerous – is it of particular danger to the rest of the world?
Of course it is. I mean, Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral is, I think, text here.
T.S. Eliot.
If you know anything of that play, and it's a brilliant play, there are four tempters that come to Thomas A. Becket and why he should oppose Henry II's effort to control the church and its law. And the fourth tempter is not anticipated, and it's, of course, hubris, pride.
One of the seven deadly sins.
Yes, yes. Right. And Becket dramatizes that he may be doing the right thing, namely opposing secular law, for the wrong reasons, namely his own personal power. Hubris plays and I think an important role not only with the president but all of his partisans. And let's more controversial and perhaps and provocative, frankly, large segments of the American population.
Sure.
This is no argument against the potential positive and indeed the record of positive achievements in the use of American power. I happen to like the outcome of World War II. I don't know about other people, and also the outcome of the Civil War.
Sure.
That is, violence has had to be invoked to produce some sort of morally, let's say, superior state, no slavery, or for that matter, no forms of oppression like fascism or communism. But that, conversely, that doesn't imply that the power that one has always leads to positive effect, especially if it's not focused or aimed or directed and positive good independent, if you will, of the moral self-approbation of the individual.
So just for the purpose of clarity, you personally are not a pacifist.
Oh, no. I'm a strong believer in basically, in terms of view of humans, more Hobbesian than may appear on the surface.
So when you refer to Hobbes, you're referring to the fact that humans may be at times dreadfully evil and may need to be restrained with physical military force to keep them from doing greater evil.
Well, I have actually two elements of it. Evil, of course, is a fundamentally moral concern, and people radically differ as to it's actually intentional and behavioral manifestations, okay? But yes, there is evil in the world. It has to be met, and sometimes evil people or movements themselves have violence at their disposition. We need no instruction when we look at marriage feasts being blown up by Al-Qaeda and the like. But there's also a more general problem that humans have to face, and this is what I really mean by Hobbesian views, is that human preferences, what we want, the kind of world we want, the kind of social order that we seek. Fundamentally, if you look at the evolution of the species since its movement out of Africa, do not converge. There's a zillion reasons why they don't converge. But that seems to me a fundamental condition of humans, partly related to their creativity, partly to differences of religion, which are are so endemic to the social order. But the absence of convergence means that somebody has to arbitrate differences. And when you exhaust appeals to moral force or principles, pragmatic adjustments, let's make a deal, then you're left only with the residual of preferences that are important to people that can't be resolved by appeal to these other forms of solution. And that's where coercion enters the picture. And that becomes the basis for the argument that no social order of any kind is likely to be able to replicate itself over time and solve this problem of where you locate violence. This administration, through the Bush Doctrine, was trying to locate it in the false claim of being a superpower.
I see. And when, in response to the violence of 9/11, the U.S. administration used military invasion of Afghanistan, was that something you were in support of?
Oh, clearly. Okay. I mean, it just seems to me Al-Qaeda are bad guys. Just don't see that nihilistic position. In fact, it's a unique form, I think, of terrorism. Up until the present condition, I'd say, of use of terrorism, let's say the anarchists of the end of the 19th century, they were usually focused on state power. This group is simply incapable of seeing any distinction between people, the innocents, and state power. It seems to me that that's a new form of nihilistic terrorism of a kind that's so virulent that has to be eliminated. And, of course, it was connected with the Taliban regime at that time.
But isn't that typical of groups that are basically on the fringe without power, that they have to become to some extent terrorists? The revolutionaries in South America who felt that there was no chance of them attacking the kind of power the state had, but who could be guerrillas?
Well, again, that distinction I'm making is that if you wanted to unravel the state power that you consider oppressive, then there's a whole range of strategies you could follow. Let's take the Algerian case, which I know it's all about, where the French were essentially the ruling power. The revolutionaries at the time against French power focused on collaborators. And so they would be eliminated in the most heinous form of way. Police who are essentially extensions of French state power were eliminated. But the focus was quite targeted.
And not on the general population.
That's right, exactly. Oh. No, there were inevitably civil strikes and killings and, as they say...
collateral damage.
I hate that word. Collateral damage, right. But the focus was on the unraveling of state power, but not on capricious killing of civilians.
But let me just push that just a little farther. What if the analysis is that, given our present state of communications and television around the world and everything, that the most effective way to bring down a powerful regime that's oppressing us, if that's our feeling, would be to do something would blow up a hospital full of children? I mean, what if you think that's the most effective way to get people's attention?
Well, yes, but that would assume to some degree that you would have a notion of what would replace it. Uh-huh. I don't find any notion of what political order would replace it after you, in effect, take such action that there are no limits to essentially a psychosis of violence. Uh-huh. In the Algerian case, there was if you look at all the self determination movements to eliminate European empires, they are all, they don't necessarily replace them with happy regimes. See the last king of Scotland if you need any instruction. But conversely, they were not animated by any notion that there wasn't some sort of replacement regime.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Professor Ed Colasier, who is director of the Center for Global Studies here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champain, former research professor and head of the political science department. Ed and I are talking about the whole issue of restoring global order after the failure of the Bush administration's doctrine, and we've talked about what that doctrine is, and we'll be getting back to that in just a moment. Let me apologize to listeners again that this particular program has been pre-recorded, and so we are not inviting callers with comments or questions this week on Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. Next week, we'll be talking, we'll be back with our regular live program, call-in program, and encourage people to call with comments or questions. We'll be talking with the director of the Hillel Foundation, Joel Schweitzer, about the and many new programs at Hillel that will be possible because of their wonderful new building that's currently under construction. And then on September 16, our guest here on Keeping the Faith, our guests will be Rafe and Jessica Malhado, and we'll be reporting on their year of Jewish studies in Israel. Those will be some of the programs coming up here on Keeping the Faith. And I might just mention that Ed Colasier will be speaking, giving a lecture on the very topic that we're discussing today, U.S. going from a superpower to a besieged global power. As part of the Friday Forum series at the University Y, where I'm the executive director, the Y has a different theme each semester that we invite local speakers and speakers from around the world to come to this campus and address. And the theme this fall is Citizenship Without Borders. We're looking at that issue from a lot of different perspectives, and Professor Colasier will be our guest on October 5th. That series starts, however, September 14 with Nick Berbulis, who's a professor of education here at the university. He'll be talking about blogs and political activism and new public spaces and how that contributes to Citizenship Without Borders. Lewis Sell will be talking about what higher education can do in a conflict-torn region, particularly referring to the destruction of Yugoslavia. September 28, William Urbach from Wisconsin will be talking about the alien in the Judeo-Christian understanding and practices. So those are some of the speakers coming up in Friday forums. Those are Friday noon lectures, free, at the University Y, 1001 South Wright Street, the corner of Wright and Chalmers, right across from Lincoln Hall, easily accessible by public transportation. The buses go by there about 20 of them an hour, so you can get to it easily. And sometimes there are parking spaces, if you insist on driving, that open up about noon. You can get a good lunch at the Y Eatery, good Thai food, thanks to Mayuri Skiasi. And so we're happy to invite people to come and have lunch or bring your own and listen to a lecture and make comments. Know Your University series of lectures also begins at the Y this September 11th, Tuesday, September 11th. We'll have representatives from the Wall-to-Wall Guitar Festival that's happening that weekend at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Richard Alkiri, Scott Swartz, David Spellman will be there to demonstrate and talk and play and answer questions. Again, noon at the Y, September 11th. And on September 18th, there's a particularly interesting program on race and ethnicity that's also tied in with the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. There's a program called NWC, which stands for three particular slurs of people of different ethnicities and races in this country. This is a performance written and performed by three friends from Los Angeles. And they're going to be performing at Krannert for two performances and also speaking at the Y with some others as to these whole issues of race and racial slurs and so on, language issues. To come to that particular program, September 18, even at the Y, will require a ticket because we want people to know there's going to be harsh language used, adult words, and we want people to know what to expect. So you need to get a ticket for that performance, but they're free. You get them at Krannert Center. You can call the center at 333-6280 or email cran-tix@uiuc.edu or go to krannertcenter.com online and get information about NWC and the program discussing that performance, those performances, and those issues, September 18 at the University Y. Well, let's get back to our guest today on Keeping the Faith. And again, we won't be accepting phone calls because this is a pre-recorded program because of difficulties with Professor Colajay's schedule and mine, I might add. So we're talking about the Bush Doctrine, and we've been talking a little bit about what kind of provoked it, most obviously the violence of 9/11. But when the Bush Doctrine got played out, why do you say that it's failed?
Oh, well, that was part of the reason for the book, was to
And you do have a book that's that you've edited that's pulling together a lot of different opinions on this issue.
Well, actually converging opinions. And the University of Georgia will be publishing this under the title that you already have indicated to the audience, namely, From Superpower to Beseech Global Power, Restoring Global Order After the Failure of the Bush Doctrine. The book had two aims. First, delineate what seemed to be the underlying notions of power and causal explanation for the use of that power, primarily what we believe was the effort to create a real new order unilaterally by the use of American power, because it was based on the notion of the U.S. as a superpower. And what we defined as a superpower is presumably a power that could get its preferences accepted by other peoples and states, either through compelling them, violence, or simply by bandwagoning on American power or moral claims and political practices.
So just join up with the U.S.
That's right. That's what bandwagoning has meant, is that the aim was so estimable for allies and neutrals that they would, of course, follow the American lead. And, of course, those who opposed it, almost by definition, or evil, or malefactors of one sort or another. And then the next reason for the book was not simply a delineation of, let's say, principles of politics and power, but was it successful or not. And what we did is we assembled by deliberation a network of foreign experts in their regions rather than the usual American suspects to evaluate whether U.S. was getting its preferences in the region and more generally globally. And when you run across the major regions of the world, Middle East and Iraq, Africa, South Asia, Southeast Asia, etc., you discover from region to region, and this is where the analysts all converge, American preferences in most all cases have been frustrated, blocked, or actually countermanded, if you will, by opposing forces. And so you come out of that review, and it was deliberately, again, not to be just so Iraq-focused. In fact, we're all navel-gazed on Iraq and forgot that there's about 6 billion other people that have to be taken into account in creating somehow a new world order, whether and that, by the way, explains why in 1989, with the fall of the wall, that I embarked on understanding what I would consider the rise of a global society of peoples who are interdependent with each other, if not necessarily of a, and by no means, as a matter of fact, agreed as to how they should construct this world order. Well, anyway, the quick review. If you go through region by region, and I'll be happy to elaborate on any region of your choice, where American preferences have been frustrated, blocked, or as a matter of fact, countervailed by opposing forces. When you look at that record, you just can't say the U.S. is a superpower, and you can't rely on that, what I consider a conceit now, for the projection of American power. That doesn't mean we're not a formidable power, don't misunderstand me, but that one can in effect command or elicit consent to American preferences as they are enunciated by whatever regime is in power. It seems to me a misnomer and a misleading form of reliance on power as to what you can actually effectively do in negotiating with the outside world.
Now, you mentioned a moral category, hubris or pride, earlier in the first half of this program as one of the things you felt was sort of strongly misleading American decision-making at the highest level. Let's get practical just for a little bit in terms of a specific region, as you invited. What about Israel, Palestine? In what sense has America's almost unswerving support of Israel with the Bush administration been thwarted?
Well, part of it was a decentralization in some ways with Israeli policy of the moment. That is, whatever the existing regime was pursuing tended to be, in effect, underwritten by the regime. Hence, increasingly, it was a neglect of the region so far as the use of American power and influence was concerned. This is in no means an argument that the preservation of Israel and the civil society in which the Israelis have created is an imperative for American foreign policy and security, as well as a moral obligation, quite apart from the practicalities of it. But that's just simply the entry fee for managing the power relationships in that region and specifically that conflict, which means Hamas, the corruption of the Palestinian Authority, and, of course, the American power not only with respect to its interests in that conflict, but throughout that entire region, and as the book also keeps focusing on, is the entire globe as a result. And so just a quick word is neglect of that region, and the recent rediscovery of it finds it actually in a position, American power and its purpose in that area, as well as the protection of Israel, in a much more weakened position than it was earlier. Hamas won an election, and we reject the outcome of the election, even though we've been promoting those kinds of elections. The Lebanese situation, if you remember, the Secretary of State said a new world order is emerging, a new order to be totally undermined by what amounted to essentially the truce that had to be negotiated by the Europeans, which had been, of course, totally marginalized after 9/11 as irrelevant to, in effect, the creation of certain kinds of circumstances in the Middle East, Iraq, and elsewhere, pure by the use of American power or so-called pickup games, coalitions of the willing. So I guess the big word is neglect more than anything else. And the Johnny-come-lately position of the United States to use its power comes in the situation which we're, I think, we're weakened as well as the Israelis of preserving their own interests as a state, as well as somehow managing, which I think is an intractable situation. If I had to put it in my terms, and again, others may disagree with me, the issue is so fundamentally, profoundly different between the conflicting actors in that area, state and peoples, including now Al-Qaeda, that the best you can hope for is to kill at a lesser rate. All right? And that means managing force and violence, partly with the use of force and violence when necessary, and of course targeted in some ways that your populations are not, in effect, brought together to oppose American and Israeli interests. Now, that's a very difficult policy to pursue, but neglecting those discriminating uses of force, positive and negative, soft and hard, is partly to me explains the weakened position of the United States in that specific area, quite apart from the weakened position globally that we now unfortunately confront.
Let me raise the issue of the two walls. You talked about the fall of the Berlin Wall as really providing a real insight into the rise of a total global society and an awareness that that there were many more actors, potential actors involved than might appear on
They're real.
They're active, yeah. But what about the wall in Israel and Palestine right now? When my wife and I were visiting there earlier this summer, we were struck by the fact that in the Palestinian territories, you know, there are evangelical Christians, there are Protestant Christians, there are Catholic Christians, there are Orthodox Christians who are Arabs on the Palestinian side, and yet they feel completely abandoned by the U.S., led by people who are supposedly very influenced by evangelical Christianity, who are totally supporting the Israeli government, who they see, who the Palestinians see, including the Palestinian Christians, as encroaching upon more and more of the Palestinian territories, and as a result, people are in desperate poverty.
Well, let me first begin. I don't know what solutions to the Middle East crisis. So the last thing I want to do is claim any kind of prescient knowledge and knowledge experience. I do understand, I believe, the conflicting power forces.
Okay.
And I would like to argue that I can provide some kind of insight into how you would manage those and go back to the notion that that the state of Israel will be under pressure for the foreseeable future. But the problem then is discriminating use of power. And now I get to your insights about that there are potential allies, such as those who are not persuaded by the notion that it should be an elimination of Israel, who are not keen on becoming Israeli citizens. They remain Palestinian in, let's say, their identities. But that requires a complicated form of diplomacy, concessions, ceaseless negotiations. Let me emphasize ceaseless negotiations and at different times targeted use of force and violence for bad guys.
On both sides?
In some ways, that's true. But you asked about the wall. You asked why it was there. That is, as I understand it, Sharon's and others of administration, which understood finally, despite about 20 years of a learning curve, that they faced the situation of a population bomb. That if you, the irony is that the radicals and some of the Palestinians want, in effect, an integrated Palestine, because they can outvote the Israelis in a democratic, quote unquote, popular election. Israel's always been set up as a free, open society, but with an ethnically defined population, though there are a large Palestinian population. our Arab population. The point of it here is that the wall seemed to be the only thing available for managing the conflict. Whether it can or not is open to questions, particularly as the settlements still continue creeping forward.
Sure.
And as long as that continues, and again, the second Bush administration, in contrast to the first administration, has essentially allowed that to continue.
Sure.
Israeli settlements in
Palestinian territory.
Yeah, yeah, some will always be on the Palestinian side, unreconciled with the principle of which they insist upon of returning home. I mean, not just off the table, but certainly compensation is certainly on the table for negotiation. But again, the administration, in fact, American policy for a long time has not confronted that issue and how it could be possibly what managed, if not resolved, that is the loss of lands.
Let's jump quickly to another region of the world just as an example, and I don't know whether this is in your book, since it's not out yet or not yet, I of course don't know, but that's the Koreas. In terms of North Korea and the Bush Doctrine's relation to that regime, we've had this long-term relation with South Korea. This university is a great example. We have over 1,000 Korean students here.
And they enrich the environment, I can tell you.
But what about the Bush Doctrine in North Korea? How has that failed from your perspective?
It succeeded only when it deviated from it. That up until only last year or so, the doctrine was isolation of North Korea, as you know, and as maximum pressure on the regime, both in economic sanctions and implicit threats of part of the axis of evil. I'm sure all of your listeners remember all of that. Well, that hitting a blank wall. The North Koreans have gone nuclear, so obviously that huffing and puffing position didn't succeed. And so it's only by abandoning now pragmatically that policy, though I might add, in contradiction to how we're handling Iran's nuclearization program and I think disastrously how we responded to Indian nuclearization. We can talk about those two deviations from the nonproliferation or in dealing with recalcitrant regimes. It's only when we, in effect, work through China, as best as I discern, and the members of the negotiating group of Japan, South Korea, to assure the North Koreans that we're not about to bomb them tomorrow. In fact, we're meeting now with them in Geneva, presumably and bilaterally, which we had refused to do earlier. So
we're meeting with them tomorrow, meaning a couple days ago.
That's right.
By the time this program comes, yes, indeed.
Touche. But now what I'm in effect saying is the policy of the Bush doctrine as applied to the Korean didn't work.
Okay.
It's only when we abandoned it, worked through China and the negotiating group, including South Korea, which was much more open for some form of negotiation. This is not an affirmation of that regime's legitimacy, but it is, in effect, a recognition that barring some kind of a direct attack, and which we're not going to about to accomplish, and, of course, the hostages that the American troops in South Korea is to North Korean use of force required some form of negotiated settlement or, again, management of the power relationships in that area.
Let me ask two questions that may not seem related, but let me ask them both at the same time and let you respond, Ed. And we're talking with Ed Colleger here on Keeping the Faith, and I'm sorry we don't have callers today, but let me ask a couple questions to follow up on this. The U.S., some people fear that the U.S. may bomb Iran to take out the nuclear potential. Is that one of your fears? That's my first question. But the second question is, there are some of the world's 1.3 billion Muslims who feel that the reason when it came to U.S. stopping the proliferation of nuclear weapons, that we didn't stop India, we didn't is because we're anti-Muslim, we're anti-Islam, and yeah, we'll let India get the bomb because of Pakistan being Muslim, and we'll let non-Muslim countries get nuclear weapons, but we'll use violence if we have to keep Muslim countries from having it. Do you see that as those are two maybe related questions?
They're very related, even though they in effect speak to different audiences. Anyone who reads Seymour Hersh's articles in the New York Times for the last several New Yorker magazine, I should say, for the last several years, already has a mirror of planning a potential attack against Iran. Why it hasn't occurred, one doesn't have to be a great specialist to understand that. We're bogged down in Iraq. We don't know where the nuclear facilities are. And so even if you wanted to attack, you're not sure it would occur. And moreover, if you did attack, then what happens to your exposed troops and your position in Iraq? And,
sure.
And one can go on with that. The recent statement by the French president, Sarkozy, which came in the wake of his meeting with the president, ostensibly, unofficially, that possibly one would have to use force. I see the connection that Sarkozy was just simply a part of the strategy of huffing and puffing and pushing. I don't see that as an independent action. And it didn't help when he said, French may not participate, so I'll hold your coat. You destroy. So, yes. One has to be very concerned that until the present administration leaves office, that some provocative act on the case of Iran and or by some frustration in concluding the Iraq war in ways that are favorable to American interests, however defined, won't lead the president to, in effect, create another fait accompli, which is an attack that is not likely to be successful. And in this case, to be pressured partly by outside forces, specifically the concern of the Israelis with the Iranian bomb. And they have a reason to be concerned. That's not a trivial matter. But the question is whether an attack by a force of that kind is likely to be successful. And all the military analysts that I happen to favor, and also my own analysis, that would be a disaster of incalculable proportions. Now it gets to your second question. Yes, indeed, it seems to me a lot of Muslims will have that idea. You're not going to convince a lot of them that that's not the case after the Iraq case, the Iraq intervention. And we were managing that whole problem. My guess is, and you're maybe a better – in fact, I know you're in a better position to answer this question than I, is that we now face as a secular and largely Christian society here in the United States a interminably long period – of efforts for reconciliation for large segments of the Muslim population. Not that we will ever convince the extremists, like the Al-Qaeda group, let us say. But that's all a part of creating a new world order in negotiating with large segments of humankind, 1.3 and enlarging in number, who want a different form of political and organization that involves much more religious penetration of political accords. This is not news to anybody. But our actions politically of the kind you've suggested and others that can be in effect easily identified and delineated, Hamas, Hezbollah, and all the rest, and managing of those groups, creates an enormously a challenging burden for this population. And the faster we inform our populations that other people just don't agree necessarily on how the world should be organized, but we very likely have, for the segments who are, let's say, balanced, sober, and want some kind of future for their peoples and their children, we can get some kind of tolerable possible arrangements with them. But right now, I think we've alienated. You go from Southeast Asia, where you had essentially a non-militant Muslim population, that I'm talking primarily about Indonesia.
And you run, the largest Muslim country.
That's right. And you run all the way through, all the way to North Africa. And you don't want to travel as an American in those areas. And that's not because you're an anti-American. Certainly I'm not. But the American position in that area, increasingly the regime in the United States and how they view Americans as much more fused than ever before. And it's not helped by evangelical Christians in the United States who are, in effect, seeing this as a kind of a second crusade. That isn't helpful at all.
Let's take another region of the world that's Muslim, 98% Muslim, and yet friendly to the West, which is Turkey.
Yeah.
How is the Bush doctrine—
Not friendly to the United States, I might add.
Not necessarily, but they're
at the moment.
They're eager to have Western Europeans, Americans, Canadians travel in Turkey, visit Turkey, see that here is a Muslim country that is nevertheless hospitable to people of other faiths, to Jews, to Christians, to Hindus, to whatever. It's a very different sort of set of issues. And yet, as you say, they're unhappy with the U.S. Why is that?
Well, that's because of several issues, certainly. But
the U.S. government.
Well, the invasion in Iraq has, of course, stirred up the problem of the Kurds. And that becomes one of the central concerns of Kurdish efforts for autonomy. And then it's spread into subversion of the Turkish regime. I think that is a principal feeling. And if you remember, the Bush administration assumed that Turkey and the military would enter the Iraq war as a part of the so-called coalition of the willing, and much to their surprise, that didn't occur. And that's just simply testimony to the problem that we have with the Turks themselves. I'm in fact, the Center for Global Studies actually sent a supported a group of high school teachers through a grant from a Turkish businessman in the United States, precisely to encourage increased cultural educational ties. In fact, we have one of our staff members is a Turkish citizen who will go back to teach in a teacher's college. And this speaks to the point of view of an openness of
yes.
the Turkish. There's no doubt with the new change in the regime that there'll be a larger religious, let's say, accent to political behavior and image of the Turkish population. But it seems to me that the notion, and you just was reaffirmed by the recent president, Gul, who is a practicing Muslim, that they will maintain their secular beginnings going back to the formation of the Turkish Republic. This speaks to a larger point. 1.3 billion Muslims are not all 1.3 billion the same Muslims.
Absolutely.
And the genius of the Bush Doctrine was to focus their antagonism to the West and fuse them against the West. If I were speaking in a pure calculating Machiavellian way, I refer back to a remark of Beaumarchais when he was asked by King Louis, why should we support these revolutionaries with assistance so they can defeat the British? And his remark was, our security lies in the division of our adversaries. Well, the absence of an understanding of the very complex differentiations of social, political evolution of the Muslim peoples from North Africa, then swarthing through the Middle East, Central Asia, through India, down South Asia, and into Southeast Asia, which represents essentially the circle of Muslim populations. To treat them all as one is just simply an escape from reality.
Let me see if in our last 30 seconds here I can summarize one point, if I understand you correctly. Would you say that the biggest failure of the Bush Doctrine is that it has unified opposition to the U.S., particularly in Muslim countries?
Yeah, that's all, and you don't need me to say that. Anyone even casually examining foreign press or American press that actually mirrors, and you won't find much of it from Fox News, I can tell you, that is the inescapable conclusion and also one of the major arguments of the book.
Now, the book you're referring to will be out in October. It's titled From Superpower to Besieged Global Power, and then a subtitle, Restoring Global Order After the Bush Doctrine's Failure, will be published by University of Georgia Press, edited by Ed Colodzie, and that's spelled K-O-L-O-D-Z-I-E-J. And you have a co-editor?
Yeah, Roger Candidate, who was a member of this faculty and head of the International Program of Studies before he went to the University of Miami.
And I saved 1 minute for you to tell us you're director of the Center for Global Studies. What does that center do here at the university?
Well, we're a grantee of the Department of Education, a grant that gave us about $1.5 million in a competition with other research universities, to globalize so-called the curriculum research and outreach activities of the university. The rationale is simple, even if complicated in execution. We live in a revolutionary time of what I would argue is a world society for the first time in the evolution of the species. We're so interdependent now, and we need better understanding of that interdependence over all areas of human concern, security, sustained economic development, human rights, all the rest. And we're trying to, in effect, transform the curriculum or assist other members of the faculty, and really everything is done by the faculty and students. Our effort is to identify those who are already doing well and to try to encourage them and also provide the support so that over time we can educate our students as citizens of the world.
I want to thank our guest today on Keeping the Faith, Professor Ed Colodzie, Director of the Center for Global Studies that he's just described here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Keeping the Faith is a weekly program that's usually a live call-in program. Today we've had to pre-record this because of scheduling issues. Next week we'll be back live and taking your comments and questions for our guest, who will be Joel Schweitzer, the director of the Hillel Foundation for Jewish Students here at the University of Illinois. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs, and I'm the director of the University YMCA, which is the oldest continuous student organization on this campus. We've been here 134 years, and although it began as an evangelical Protestant Christian organization, it's been open to people of other faiths and people of no particular religious background for many decades. We're involved in community service and social action. We have many programs for university students, but also some for people in the community. So I invite people to participate, for example, in Communiversity, one of the Y programs, where we have non-credit courses on everything from starting your own business to dealing with plants and money matters and martial arts and social dancing. All these are activities that you can learn about at the Y. Pick up a brochure for Communiversity at the University Y, 1001 South Wright. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Once upon a time, people believed the world was populated with terrible monsters and mythical beasts. They thought if they just searched long enough and hard enough, they'd find them. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, the mythical beasts of folktale and legend and the modern researchers who are still hunting them. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, clear with a low in the lower 50s and light winds, becoming southwest around 5 miles per hour after midnight. Tomorrow, Labor Day, sunny with a high in the upper 80s and light west winds. Tomorrow night, mostly clear, the low in the upper 50s with light south winds. Tuesday, sunny with a high in the lower 90s. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: AgriGold Hybrids, Mahomet, Bates Commodities Incorporated, Normal, Busey Bank, Colonial Pantry, Champaign, and Spectrum Consulting, Mattoon. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.